Defense Counsel for Mr. Cutler, and I come from Carbondale. I would like to start with what is the second part of my first argument, which is that the statements by the district attorney in the opening argument impermissibly, and in this case with plain error, substantially violated Mr. Cutler's right to a fair trial. It went directly to the relationship of the Fifth Amendment, the right to have counsel, the right to remain silent. It went directly to the Sixth Amendment, the right to have counsel and competent counsel. The statements that the defense was going to treat the jury like idiots, dogs should don't eat my homework, don't do this, pissing in the rain, are not opening statements. They are not commentaries on the facts that are going to be presented in evidence. I think it's important to recall that an opening statement is an opening statement of the evidence to be presented, not argument. All of the cases that go to closing argument with some rhetorical flourishes still would probably prohibit the statements that were made in this opening, but it is a different perspective for a closing than an opening. And in this case, the line was crossed and crossed. One of the factors the court will have to find plain error, as it was only objected to once, so it's sort of a hybrid of the standard of review in this, is that there was proof of bad faith and manifest prejudice to Mr. Cutler. The bad faith is evidenced by the fact that it didn't happen once, it didn't happen twice, it happened several times in that district attorney's opening argument, and it had obviously happened with some pre-thought. She states, I have cleaned this statement up, but where I come from, and please don't be offended. So she knew the extreme of her statement, because don't be offended, you're trying to settle the jury down. This went directly to saying that the defendant and his counsel were lying to them. And that is totally impermissible. Mr. Cutler needs a new trial because of the substantial and structural error that occurred by those statements in opening. After that, it was downhill completely. Secondly, it also impeded on Mr. Cutler's right to remain silent. He chose not to testify in that trial. But they have already made a comment on that is an allegorical to the right to remain silent. He's lying to you. He's lying to you. That's not what the evidence presented at this trial. It was a fairly simple trial. But what the evidence at that trial presented was the co-defendant said he didn't have anything to do with it. Then they called two probation officers to put on, I guess, allegedly the statement of a co-conspirator that were contrary or a prior inconsistent statement. The policeman never saw Mr. Cutler with this wire. He never obtained a warrant to search Mr. Miller's car where the wire was found. Everything in this case pointed to Miller, Miller, Miller. The evidence was not overwhelming, as the district attorney said. And by inferring in that Mr. Cutler was lying or would be lying to the jury or treating the jury like idiots, all of which is an insult to the process, the district attorney crossed a line that cannot happen in a fair and fundamental trial.
Scotty, let me ask you a question. Is there a distinction between using the word lying and using other words? And what authority do you have with reference to opening statement on this point?
The Crider v. Pieper case cited, I believe, in my reply brief that came out in 2008, the Colorado Supreme Court clearly stated, in this jurisdiction, it is improper for a lawyer to use any form of the word lie in characterizing for a jury a witness's testimony or his truthfulness. So yes, there's some recent authority on that.
And where in this opening statement did the prosecutor say lie?
She didn't say lie. She missed the one trick word. But to say, in the minority, you say, don't tell me you're pissing, don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining. That is saying you're lying. Obviously, if you're pissing down their back, it's not rain. It's a lie. And that's what she's saying. And then she continued on with further statements such as, the dog ate my homework. Congress gives money for bailouts or something like that. I can't remember. It went on and on. And then later, at some point, over objection, finally, she says, and now the defendant and his counsel are going to insult your intelligence. Now, that's not a lie, but that is an improper statement and an improper characterization of the evidence that goes to the whole reason they can't say lie, because the jury believes there's something else out there this person knows, and you are bringing in passion and prejudice. You're not just relying on the facts that are presented. Nothing was presented about rain. I mean, to be literal in this, nothing. So in this case, she is saying lie. She is saying don't believe them. She is saying they are insulting you. And it is all absolutely impermissible opening statement. And it needs to be reversed on that grounds.
And this is structural error?
Yes, it is, because it goes to the actual fundamental elements of this fair trial. The state is saying, this person is saying you're lying, is treating you like an idiot. That is absolutely impermissible.
And Ms. Gowdy, can you explain how it affects the framework of the trial? You're saying it's impermissible, but what is the framework that was not afforded in this case?
It's a commentary on the evidence by impressing your personal opinion on it, which a prosecutor is not permitted to do. And the cases are fairly strong on that, that if you go to passion and prejudice, and that's the Ali case, in fact, that was cited by the people. If you go to passion and prejudice instead of the facts before you, it is an impermissible and reversible error, because the jury is not supposed to be there using passion and prejudice. They're supposed to be fair and impartial. And that's where it's the whole structure of our jury system. That's where it is.
And does Ellie say that that is structural error, or what is the standard that we review under that case?
Under Ellie, the standard was reversible only on proof of bad faith, and that was coding bowels, I believe. So I believe that's the standard. The structural error, I'm trying to find where in my notes where I just saw it in a case. If I may come back to that, it's in my notes somewhere. I'm sure it'll pop back out. I'm sorry. The other violation that occurred in this case, then, was the officer's statement of opinion on footprints. And from the record, it's fairly unclear what was going on. The officer was asked to comment on whether or not the shoe and the shoe print were similar. And it was objected to as calling for an expert opinion. It also invades the province of the jury, because the jury is perfectly capable of looking at the footprint and the shoe themselves. It does not need an officer to say, I believe that this is the same.
They can do it like.
Because the officer is giving testimony that he's invading the province of the jury unless he's an expert. A Rule 702 expert can start to comment and make the comparisons, do some of that jury education, but a lay person, expert can only talk about what their own perceptions are and not take it beyond.
Isn't that what he did? He just said, it looks like they're similar. I think that was the word he used. They're similar. Isn't that what a layman would conclusion draw looking at the two? And the jury is certainly free to do the same thing?
The jury is certainly free to do the same thing. I think what we have is a balance between the case of Varon and the case of Tall White Men, both decided by various panels on this court.
Well, I had a case in practice involving a boot print, just very similar to this. And the expert opinion is the boot made the print, the boot could have made the print, the boot did not make the print. Those are the three opinions that are an expert. One of those three opinions is what the expert would render. Here the officer just said it looks like it. Is that really an opinion?
Yes. I mean, he's saying it looks like it. Yes, it is an opinion. Whether or not it was objected to as expert, it was objected to as non-relevant, it shouldn't have been asked, it was not needed, it was not necessary, and it went into areas that had not been endorsed. I see that I see you have more questions on that. There is a line when there's a policeman on the stand, and the policeman has that imprimatur of power and of knowledge and of training. And to ask that person puts him into the stance of an expert if he's giving opinions that are not just going to be drawn directly from by the jury themselves. The footprint was not done correctly. They didn't put any kind of ruler next to it. There was nothing to say, is this a common shoe? There was no comparison done until it happens in the courtroom, no testing. And he was being used as an expert. And if you're going to use him as an expert, you need to endorse him as an expert. And qualify him. So with that, I would reserve time for rebuttal at that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Carl Spedigue, attorney registration 39208, and I represent the people in this matter. I want to start with the first issue because it seems to me like counsel is sort of glomming together all the different instances that she objected to in her opening brief, and I kind of want to parcel it out for you because I think it makes a little more sense that way. The defendant takes issue with two specific statements during the prosecutor's opening remarks, one of which was objected to, one of which was not. The statement, the statement where the prosecutor says something to the effect of the defendant is going to try and insult your intelligence was promptly objected to by defense counsel and immediately sustained by the district court. So there was no error there. The district court sustained it immediately. The second statement was an introduction where essentially the prosecutor was attempting to convey to the jury that the defendant's version of the events was not credible. Now, in making this argument,
is that appropriate in opening statement?
Now, opening statement is supposed to be where you are setting out what you're going to present.
Answer my question. Was that appropriate comment in an opening statement?
I think her choice of words was poor. She was trying to say, I'm going to show you how the defendant's version of the events is not what the evidence shows.
So if the statement is inappropriate, where do we go from here?
Well, I would argue that while it was a poor choice of words, agreed, first, I think we need to back up to the standard of review because counsel is sort of arguing that we have a constitutional issue, that there's all these violations of the defendant's amendment rights, but if you'll see when v. People, the prosecutorial error, while it can implicitly affect a defendant's fair trial, there's not a broad rule that says this is constitutional. It has to actually be a constitutional. In that case, the word lie was used impermissibly and affected the impartiality of the jury, but did not directly impact the defendant's constitutional rights. Same kind of situation here. There's no direct impact to the defendant's constitutional rights, and therefore, we're not dealing with constitutional error. This is a plain error standard of review.
You would agree this stepped over the line.
I'm not conceding that this was error by any means. I agree that this was a poor choice of words by the prosecutor. I think that she could have...
Poor choice of words because of the analogy or because the inference?
Well, it seems a little crass for court, I would say.
But what's the inference?
Well, I don't agree that it is an automatic inference that he's lying. I think what she's trying to say is what he's going to try and tell you is not a credible version with the evidence that I'm going to present. I think that's what she was trying to say.
It's a close case.
I don't believe so, no. In fact, I would say that to provide the court with a little bit of factual context, the defendant and a friend were found in the early morning hours in an empty field in possession of large black trash bags full of stolen copper wire.
He was never found in possession of a trash bag, was he?
Well, he was found with a bicycle. The policeman had driven by and seen a man with a bicycle and, pardon? Two men, but then saw one that had the trash. I'm sorry, my recollection is a little hazy because I haven't seen the record in a couple
months. I don't think he was ever seen with a trash bag.
Well, he was found with a wrench in his pocket. His shoes were arguably matched the footprints found below the the light poles where the copper wire had been stolen, and then the truck was nearby. And when the police officers first asked him what he was doing, he said he was looking for lizards. And then later on, during trial, basically said it was all the co-defendant. I had nothing to do with this. I was just at the wrong place at the wrong time. So I would argue that that was actually pretty substantial evidence to say that the defendant was at a minimum involved, and you know, who knows if he was, you know, the main perpetrator or an accomplice, but you know, for sure I would say that that he was involved and that there was plenty of evidence to support that he was implicit in that involvement. So based on this, the prosecutor was trying to set the stage, if you will, regarding how the evidence presented by the prosecution would be inconsistent with his version of the events. That I didn't do it, I was just looking for lizards.
That's not even an appropriate comment in an opening statement, is it? My evidence is going to be A, B, C, and D, and at the close of that evidence, I'm going to ask you to return a verdict of guilty. What the opening statement is sort of limited to?
But I would say that you're allowed to kind of set a framework for what you're about to show. And while you may not...
This isn't set a framework. Attacking the defense.
So let's assume that this was error and that he should not, that this...
The next question is, it obvious error?
I would say no, absolutely not, because plain error has to undermine the fundamental fairness of the trial. And I would argue this defendant had, you know, he went through the whole trial process. Like the counsel said, this trial was fairly simple and there was plenty of evidence. Never did the prosecutor say that the defendant used the word lie, which is one of the bad words according, you know, to the Supreme Court, nor did he call the defendant any names. You know, I would point to People v. Hernandez, which I cited in my case, where it was not even plain error where a prosecutor called the defendant a rat during opening statements. Now, I would argue this was much less egregious than that, characterizing the defendant as, you know, some sort of derogatory animal term.
Why would a trained district attorney risk spoiling the whole trial in the opening 30 seconds by making a statement like this?
Well, I would argue that she's not trying to risk the trial. I really don't.
Well, she's not trying to, but she's coming very close.
And I see that you find it fairly egregious, and I would argue.
So do I.
And I would say that I understand her choice of words was very poor, and I'm not trying to defend them in any way in saying that they were proper and should be used, you know, regularly by district attorneys. But I would also say I think she was trying to tell the jury, look, this is a case where the defendant...
He's going to lie to you.
There's a lot of things pointing in one direction, and the defendant is going to try to point you right over here, which is every case, frankly. You know, every case, this is what we're going to come up against. We're going to say, you know, he says this, we say this. Now...
You didn't comment on what he says in an opening statement. You comment on what your evidence is going to be.
I agree.
And what witnesses you're going to call and what you expect them to say. You don't...
There was also a comment about a dog eating homework or something like that.
Well, that was also within the context of that, of this. I mean, it was just kind of a continuation.
And so what's the inference on that?
That... I think it's the same. Like, his version is going to be inconsistent with what I'm about to show you. Here's what I'm going to present to you, and it's going to be completely, wholly inconsistent with what he's about to tell you.
Well, can a prosecutor even state that before any evidence has come in about the inconsistencies of the defendant's case when there has not yet been a case?
Well, according to... I'll tell you... Henwood v. People, which I agree is... a 1914 Colorado Supreme Court case. So it's very old. But
when was it decided?
1914.
That's very old.
It's just very old.
I thought you were going to say 1940, and I was going to call you into question on
that. No.
Go ahead.
However, it states that the purpose of an opening statement is to acquaint the jury with the nature of the case they have been selected to consider, advise them briefly regarding the testimony which it is expected will be introduced to establish the issues involved, and generally give them an understanding of the case from the viewpoint of counsel making the statement so that they will be better able to comprehend the case as the trial proceeds. Now, I recognize that there has been case law since then and that, you know, really it should mostly be limited to the facts in question. I would argue this prosecutor probably stepped outside those bounds. However, I think there was no malicious intent here. She was merely trying to give a framework here. Here's what I'm about to show you. Here's about what I'm about to present to you. And her choice of words was admittedly very poor. And
isn't this almost evidence that she thinks she has a weak case?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. I would say that she was feeling that she needed some sort of snazzy introduction. Maybe she's, you know, maybe that was
snazzy?
That's her style. I don't know. I can't speak for her, but perhaps that's how.
We're not blaming you for it.
However, I don't believe that this goes to the level of plain error. Again, I would point to the Hernandez case.
Me back to my next question. Was it obvious? I asked you that earlier. In order to be plain error, it's got to be obvious. It's got to be obvious to the trial court that this is improper argument. And he or she should do something about it without the benefit of an objection.
Well,
that's the first part of the analysis. Is it obvious?
I don't think it's that obvious, because she spent, like counsel points out, she spent a good time saying, okay, I understand, you know, this, here's a saying that I think encompasses kind of the theme of this case, and I would like you to consider it, but, you know, understand that I don't want you to be offended by it. And she tries to, you know, keep it as, I guess, cleaned up version of it as possible.
Next question.
And then goes to
next
explain
question. It. Should it cause us to question the validity of the verdict?
No, absolutely not. I don't believe so. The evidence was, you know, fairly strong in this case. I would say that there was no issue as to, you know, I think that there was plenty of evidence against the defendant here, and all the rest of the trial, you know, as we said, was fairly simple and smooth, and there wasn't anything to say that he didn't receive a fair shake. No, I think he was perfectly fine. And I think the court should note that there was no objection. If it was that awful and that egregious, why didn't he object?
Practical reasons.
In fact, he used it in his own opening. He said, I'm not pissing down your back and telling you it's raining. He used the same exact aphorism to sort of support his position that, you know, the defendant was going to be, you know, it's a truthful person who's going to tell you everything he needed to say, and, you know, that you should believe his version of the events. So,
in fairness, was not defense counsel trying to minimize the bad effect of that comment?
Perhaps. That could be one interpretation, but the same interpretation could be that, you know, he was also using it to show the opposite. As to the defendant's second argument, I just want to briefly say, it seems like Judge Roy's had some experience with boot prints, and so I would just say again, this is a, you know, police officers have a standard where it's widely accepted that they can regularly and appropriately offer testimony under 701 based on their perceptions and experiences under tall white men. It would encroach on expert testimony if this was under some sort of specialized knowledge or training that he used in order to make this comparison, but it was literally, here's the boot, here's the print. Do you think they look similar? In fact, he said, in my observation, yes, they're consistent. And that was it. And then it was given to the jury and taken away. So,
Ms. Spettiger, can you clarify for me, because I know one of the assertions is that this was not expert testimony, but there was also the assertion made that this was testimony that was usurping on the role of the jury as something separate, of saying here the police officer was telling the jury what something showed rather than the jury making their own determination.
It was presented to the jury, given, it was offered as proof to the jury, given to them to, you know, make their own, and they were given a jury instruction that said you're willing to disregard, you know, any testimony given before you. So it's, we presume the jury to follow those instructions, and I just don't think there's any record support for that.
The officer didn't say this shoe matches this print.
No, I can tell you exactly what he said. He said, the prosecutor asked, based on your observation and not opinion, just what you're looking at, is that consistent, the sole of that shoe consistent with the pattern you observe in that photograph in the soil? Yes, this particular pattern on the sole of the ball of the foot is what I was mostly looking at, the photographs and the shoe print. That was the extent of the exchange for that. Is there no further questions? I would ask that you please affirm the conviction, and thank you for your time.
I first need to apologize. I misspoke. I couldn't read my handwriting from taking notes in the car. It isn't structural damage. It is substantial damage to the structure of a fair trial. And that's the standard, and I apologize for that. And I believe that comes from the Bowles case as well. The test here is first of all, was there prosecutorial misconduct? There clearly was. It was premeditated just by her own statements in that, saying, I'm going to say things, I've modified it, I've prepared it.
I think the Attorney General is.
Okay. Secondly, then, it goes to whether there has been, let me find my notes so I get it correct this time, a framework has been destroyed of this fair trial. This trial was not a strong case for the prosecution. He was never found with the wire. He was on a bike. It wasn't his truck. So far, it is not illegal in Colorado to have a wrench in your pocket.
And the principal involved said he had nothing to do with it.
Right. So it became, so what the whole trial came down to was credibility of the witnesses between them, the credibility of the co-defendant, the credibility of the probation officers, and it was all a credibility match. And to
and he knew the co-defendant, right?
Mr. Cutler? Yes.
And was the co-defendant's identification found in the truck?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Miller's identification, well, it was found in the truck. Not Mr. Cutler.
And stolen goods were in the truck.
I don't know if they established that the ones in the truck were stolen, but they found ones that were similar to the stolen goods in the truck. But they didn't find Mr. Cutler in the truck. He was there on his bicycle. They didn't find that his bicycle had been brought there in a truck. So
but the officer did see somebody riding a bicycle with a bag.
Yes, but he also said it was the different person that he saw later without the bag. What they did is find the bag in the field and Mr. Cutler remaining without a bag on his bike on the street. And he talked to the officer. No consciousness of guilt. So when you have what, I hate to bring in the analogy from that opening argument, a pissing match between your witnesses, then to bring that analogy in and say, you can't believe them, they are treating you like idiots, has gone to the fundamental fairness of the trial. It has gone to the credibility, which is the issue that this case was being tried on, and impermissibly tainted the jury by all of the power of the state of Colorado. If there are no further questions, I have nothing else. Thank you.
The case will be deemed submitted. We thank both counsel for the briefs and arguments. And a written opinion will issue in due course.